Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Senator Chuck Schumer blasts the red flag gun legislation as ineffective cop-out. Senate Minority Leader Schumer today poured cold water on the red flag legislation that is gaining traction among some Senate Republicans in the wake of a pair of mass shootings over the weekend, calling the measure an ineffective cop-out. Schumer says, "The notion that passing a tepid version of an extreme risk protection order bill alone is even close to getting the job done in addressing rampant gun violence in the U.S. is wrong and would be an effective cop-out," according to Schumer. Here's the president from his address on Monday speaking to this issue.
Third, we must reform our mental health laws to better identify mentally disturbed individuals who may commit acts of violence and make sure those people not only get treatment, but when necessary, involuntary confinement. Mental illness and hatred pulls the trigger, not the gun. Fourth, we must make sure that those judged to pose a grave risk to public safety do not have access to firearms, and that if they do, those firearms can be taken through rapid due process. That is why I have called for red flag laws, also known as extreme risk protection orders. Today, I'm also directing the Department of Justice to propose legislation ensuring that those who commit hate crimes and mass murders face the death penalty, and that this capital punishment be delivered quickly, decisively, and without years of needless delay.
So, instead of adopting clear and balanced legislation limiting access to assault rifles, large-capacity magazines, military-grade ammunition, etc., Congress considers red flags? Who will be targeted by these red flags? Would these red flags have stopped any of the most recent shootings? Is this just a way for both sides of the aisle to claim that they're doing something while not really getting anything done? Or, even though it is not a solution, is it a step in the right direction? For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. She is a communications specialist for In the Public Eye Communications, Joya Jefferson Neary. Joya, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me back.
So there's a lot of this must stop and these shootings are unacceptable. And there's an awful lot of hand-wringing. But at the end of the day, where are we?
Right where we were last week. Right where we were after Columbine. Right where we were after Sandy Hook. We're nowhere. Even though the NRA is on its decline, as the president said yesterday, there is no political appetite to take away assault rifles. And that is some level of absurd. But I have to tell you, Wilmer, when Sandy Hook happened and blonde hair, blue eyed little kindergarten children were killed, and our country did nothing about assault rifles, no one went to jail, no gun seller, no gun show, nothing. When nothing happens, when no major laws were changed, I knew that when we can lose young white babies and nothing is done, the rest of us are just toast.
That is, you're absolutely, I think, absolutely correct. And so now we've got this conversation about red flag laws or extreme risk protection order laws where family members, law enforcement officials, and in some cases, other individuals have the ability to petition a judge to temporarily remove firearms from people believed to pose a danger to themselves or others. 17 states and the District of Columbia have enacted versions of these laws, which vary widely in terms of who can use them. For example, in New York, a school administrator can file a petition. In Hawaii, a coworker can do so. Are these measures by themselves an ineffective cop-out, or combined with an assault weapon ban and national background checks, could they be effective responses to this problem?
I think the most effective response to this problem is to forbid the average citizen from having an assault weapon, period. Not one, not two. That assault weapons are used in the military and the military only. The red flag laws, I don't understand why you need a law for that. If I found out when you had 17 assault rifles in your basement, why wouldn't I just call the police? Why do I need a law for that? If I'm working in a school and I see in the locker if one of the kids have an assault weapon or a weapon of any kind, why don't I just call the police? I don't understand what that law does except to make legislators look like they're busy.
You know, first of all, an assault weapon, which is a military style, a militarily designed weapon, is not designed to hunt animals. It's only designed to hunt human beings.
It destroys an animal that you shoot with it.
Exactly.
And I also think it makes it not a fair fight. You have an assault weapon, and the animal only has speed and wild. So I don't understand why you, if it's a sport, why do you need an assault weapon? Let's even the playing field for a little bit. First off, why don't you go out there and get the animal with a knife? But I don't understand what the assault rifle piece is. But I do understand is we're not actually looking at the issue.
Correct.
I don't think the issue is about guns or whether or not we want to have a red flag law or whatever. I think this is about the ability for the majority population to arm itself against other members of the population, because they're not killing each other on the street. They're coming in and mass murdering people from some level of ideology, from the Unabomber who didn't mass shoot people, but from Oklahoma City to Columbine, people have political philosophies that they enact with these guns. We're not addressing those philosophies. We're not addressing the hate. We're not addressing any of that. We just want to get rid of the guns. I want to get rid of the guns, too, but I think we have to do it in a larger conversation than just taking the gun, because we know throughout Europe, people have killed just as many people with a car or a truck. So it's about the hatred, and it's about our ability to be to see the next person as a human being. And I don't think the rhetoric of modern-day politics or the politics throughout the history of our country allows us to embrace that.
Let's unpack a bit of what the president said on Monday. He said, first, we must reform mental health laws to better identify mentally disturbed individuals. And that's interesting to me, since the deinstitutionalization process in this country came at the hands of the Reagan administration. And it was the Reagan administration that literally closed mental institutions in this country and dumped millions of people on the street that should have, were, and could have been institutionalized. Now they're a major part of our homeless population in this country.
They are. But I don't know if you can blame an action that happened 40 years ago and what happened over this past weekend. I don't think the mental illness problem in this country has anything to do with, I don't think, what Ronald Reagan did 40 years ago. That was a very bad move. And I think what happened with Ronald Reagan is that generation after generation, the homeless population tends to be military men and women who have served our country, which for me seems absurd. We send them off to possibly lose their lives, the supreme measure of patriotism. And then when they come home, we act like we don't know them. But I think what's happening now with mental illness is that we actually don't care until something like this happens. We actually don't care. How often do we run past people, walk past people on the street you know have a mental illness? And how often, not just on the federal level, but on the local level, when we go to get money to help the homeless and help the mentally ill, oh, there's no money for that. We don't have money for that. We can have a war. There's plenty of money for that. We can make our police departments, military units, plenty of money for that. But not for that man and woman and children on the streets without homes, which causes mental illness, may be the cause why they're on the street. We don't actually have a national compassion for that. And I just think teleprompter Don, just said what he had to say. I don't think anything's going to happen. I'm telling you. After Sandy Hook, I was done. I'm like, this is never going to happen in my lifetime.
I brought up Reagan not because there is a direct correlation between the deinstitutionalization policies of the Reagan administration and today. I brought it up because that was a Republican administration that 40 years hence, another Republican administration is now at least articulating the reversal of that policy. To me, it shows the disconnect in thinking between Trump today and Reagan then. And I add to that, he also says to me to further show disconnect, the death penalty for domestic terrorism. First, domestic terror is not a federal crime. So he's calling for the death penalty for an action that is not a federal crime, and he wants to impose the death penalty swiftly without the ability to appeal. What would, to me, that's really problematic, if not unconstitutional. So again, it's a disconnect. Go ahead.
It's totally unconstitutional. It's not going to go any further than his speech because it's unconstitutional, and no judge is going to allow him or anybody to call for the death penalty for anybody without the right of appeal. But it is a dog whistle to his constituency who believe in the death penalty in the first place, don't understand how the death penalty, how people get years before their execution, why the appeals take years. Because, you know, there's somebody who murdered the sweet young woman in their town, and they don't understand how he's sitting on the death on the death row for 20 years because he gets that level of appeal. So this is another campaign speech, and he's just dog whistling to his people.
And he's trying to disguise that as a cohesive, coherent response to a serious national problem and not really thinking through the implications and ramifications of what it is that he's calling for.
We're sitting here just a month from Labor Day, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I want you to have me back on right after Labor Day.
Okay.
And let's discuss whether or not this is part of the political discourse moving forward.
Okay.
Do we do this? We get really excited right after there are people being shot and killed. We're all in it. We're going to do this. And, you know, Congress is on recess. By the time they come back after Labor Day, they'll move on to something else unless there's another mass shooting. I have no faith. I have no faith.
Oh, I'm with you. I'm with you, which is why, again, red flag orders in and of themselves, it's old wine in new bottles, and it's not going to bring about any substantive change to the situation.
No great change.
Now, if you were to take red flag laws, assault weapons ban, background checks, if you were to put those three things into some legislation and get that legislation passed and signed by the president, now you've got something in your hands that you can work with. But
there's one other thing you have to add to that.
Go ahead.
You have to get it written, passed, signed by the White House, and enforced.
Got you.
Enforced. There are a lot of books on the laws that we don't enforce.
Got you. And here's the other question. Red flag laws in and of themselves, who do we think they will be used against in the process? Who's the population or populations?
Oh, let me guess.
Go ahead. Take a swag.
But can I reverse that question for just a little bit?
Sure, go ahead.
I think if you look at the demographics of the people who are doing the mass murders,
mm-hmm.
they are the same people who are never profiled by the police,
mm-hmm.
never stopped and frisked,
mm-hmm.
okay, never stopped in an airport. And so how many of these mass murders are we going to have to do before law enforcement across the board red flags these people?
Well, that's a very, very, very good question, a very apt question. And as evidence to your point, the one thing that we don't hear, well, let me put it another way. This weekend is the first time I've heard these mass shootings put into a generalized context of white supremacy. Up until this point, these shootings have been discussed as acts of crazed individuals.
Right. It's not individual madman. It's not terrorism, and it's not white supremacy, like you said, until this past weekend.
Now the media is forced to put this in a context of racism, white supremacy. The problem is now the conversation is, well, why now? How have we gotten here? Failing to understand and appreciate this has been America since the first enslaved Africans arrived on these shores in 1619.
Exactly.
That's the broader context. And we could go through, in fact, I just wrote an op-ed to this point. We can go through whether it be presidential statements, whether it be Supreme Court decisions, as in Dred Scott and a black man has no rights that a white man is bound to. American history is replete. Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal. American history is replete with evidence of a mindset that Donald Trump's language is merely reflecting. He is not the creator. He has just recently been the accelerant to the problem. Real quick, because we've got just a couple minutes before we got to get out of here. The president goes to Dayton. The president goes to El Paso, Texas today on a healing tour here. Many people there are saying you're the wrong guy to bring healing to this circumstance. Your thoughts?
He's the wrong guy to bring healing to these circumstances. He's the wrong guy. He has inflamed even the former head of the KKK supported Donald Trump, and Donald Trump didn't object to that support in 2016. I don't understand how he thinks that he can just all of a sudden become presidential when even in Charlottesville, he said there are good people on both sides. There are not good people on both sides of this. There are not, if we believe one tenet of our Bill of Rights, if you're going to stand here and say, I'm going to take your life because of the color of your skin, you're not a good person. That may seem very elementary, but we have to decide that people don't get away with this. There's a photograph in the news now of policemen in Texas on horseback.
Right.
Walking a black man with a noose around his neck down the street.
No, actually, that's not accurate. He's being led down the street by a rope that is tied to the handcuffs behind his back. There is no noose around his neck. We got to be accurate.
Okay.
We got to be accurate.
There was no noose around his handcuffs.
Right.
I just don't understand how the officers doing that didn't have a lens that said, you know what, this may not look right. This may not be right.
This is not a good idea.
This may not be humane.
This is not a good idea.
That is a human being, but the police officers, I'm assuming, didn't see him as a human being.
Well, and as the family has said, and others in the area have said, now we got to get out, they're familiar with the guy because he has a history of mental illness. He's been homeless for a number of years, and his family has said the police know him, and the people in the area know him.
All the more reason
there you
to
go.
Treat him with dignity.
Well, let me say this as we get out. Based upon his trip to Dayton today and his trip to El Paso today, if the president were to come on television tonight or tomorrow and say, you know what? I've learned something with these two trips. I've made a very big mistake. I need to correct my language. And here's, you know, something to that effect. He would almost guarantee reelection in 2020.
No.
If he were to, go ahead.
He would. If he read it from a teleprompter, his people would know he's being told what to say. If he walked out there for a press conference tonight and did it without a teleprompter,
okay.
He might even convince me
that
he had remorse about the words he has said in the past.
As a communications expert, I know you know what you're talking about.
Exactly. If he came out there with no teleprompter and just fumbled around the words and got from place to place the way he is his style, I would think maybe that's someplace of sincerity. So he comes out there and reads the teleprompter. It's all his good people in the communications office and his speechwriters telling him what to say now so there's not a complete and utter disaster.
Joya Jefferson Neary, communications specialist for In the Public Eye Communications, as always. Thank you for your time. Ebony has you on the calendar. We're going to get you on after Labor Day, and we're going to see if your projection for the future is correct. Thank you very much, Joya. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. having me.
All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is a fantastic piece in Common Dreams entitled Citing Racist Massacres and Inexcusable Prevalence of Guns, Foreign Countries Issue Travel Safety Warnings for the United States. The world is watching. While President Donald Trump and the Republican Party have spent the past several years claiming foreign migrants and refugees pose a threat to Americans, a pair of massacres in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio over the weekend has compelled two Latin American countries to warn their own citizens of the travel dangers lurking in the United States. What does this really say now as we look at this from the outside in? For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He is a Democratic strategist and principal at National Capital Strategy Group, Douglas Sloan. Douglas, welcome and thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We are also joined by a professor of political science at Hamline University, author of Presidential Swing States, When Only 10 Matter, as well as a new piece in Counterpunch, The New Politics of the White Supremacist Evangelical Republican Party, Professor David Schultz. David, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me again.
So, Douglas, let me start with you. Your thoughts now as we start really to not only assess the El Paso shooting, the Dayton, Ohio shooting, but also so many of the others that have taken place very, very, very recently. Now, this is focused from the outside in.
Yeah. And I think the language used by the foreign ministries of Venezuela and Uruguay was telling, and I could just quote it from the article, said both countries inform their citizens of the indiscriminate possession of guns by the U.S. population and the refusal of the federal government to address the problem. That hits the nail on the head right there. We have unfettered access to firearms, and our Congress and sitting president refuse, outright refuse, to do anything to address the situation of mass shootings and indiscriminate violence by U.S. citizens with these weapons of war that they have access to. And it's not a mental health problem. It's not because of the video games. It's not because, oh, we have a mental health problem. Other countries have mental health problems. Other countries play video games. But they do not have this unfettered access to guns. And that is where our problem lies.
And it lies to unfettered access in a culture, a gun culture, a violent culture. Professor David Schultz, your thoughts, sir?
Well, first off, I was going to say that what the piece points out is that more mass killings take place by white supremacists than they take place by what? Immigrants or undocumented aliens. And so, I mean, right off the bat, I think the piece highlights that, that as much as Trump wants to say that what people coming in from outside the United States are what? Rapists, murderers, et cetera, as far as I can tell, unless I'm missing something, not too many of them. In fact, I don't think any of them are committing mass killings in the way we're seeing white supremacists who are doing it. So that's sort of the first point. The second point here is that, and this is the piece that I did today also in Counterpunch, is to say that there is something locked in the culture of part of the United States where guns are inextricably connected, and it's the white supremacist aspect of our culture. Because if we go back, I don't know, let's say 100, 150 years at least, it's these militias that wanted to have guns not just to what? Defend themselves against alleged government atrocities, but to what? To keep down freed slaves. Guns have always been an issue about race. Keep guns out of people who are people of color, but let whites have them, and they're going to be used against people of color.
And Douglas, going on with the Common Dreams piece, the government of Venezuela says these increasing acts of violence have found an echo and support in the conversations and actions impregnated by racial discrimination and hatred against migrant populations, pronounced and executed by the supremacist elite who holds power in Washington. The supremacist elite. I found that to be incredibly powerful language.
Very interesting, and I just want to point out that this is the article by Julia Connolly, staff writer at Common Dreams. But yes, that language was very powerful and quite frankly points directly to the White House regarding the supremacist elite and some of the racially tinged rhetoric that our president has been using that has inspired some of these white supremacists that have taken up arms and gone out on these shooting sprees. You see the manifesto, I believe, by, and there's been so many shootings in the past.
You lose track.
Just in the past week, yeah, but I believe it was the El Paso shooter. It mirrored some of the language that Trump has been using in his speeches and tweets over the past several months. And I believe the FBI has also taken up an investigation into the shooting in California at the Garlic Festival regarding that possibly being a hate crime. So we know that El Paso was motivated by hate, but also the shooting in California seemed to be motivated by hate.
They just don't know who he hated.
Right. They just don't know who he hated. Right. Yeah, yeah. And that one was, you know, I guess he was a completely equal opportunity shooter in that he shot a lot of white people and a couple of black people and maybe a couple of Latinos there, whereas El Paso seemed to focus on Hispanics and in Dayton seemed to focus on black people. So it really is, the doctor's right, it really is one of the major underlying problems to this wanton violence in our society regarding mass shootings is this white supremacist culture that must be addressed and is only being further ignited by the man in the White House.
And David, in the Common Dreams piece, again, the language supremacist elite, you write, despite Trump's horrendous racist, xenophobic, and misogynist language and a personal lifestyle that lives this rhetoric, Republicans and white evangelicals are with him. And then you give some Pew data and you give some Marist data. Talk about that piece, please.
Yeah. What I was trying to argue is that what Trump has achieved is bringing together three constituencies under the Republican Party and transforming them. He first has taken the traditional Republican Party, which in many ways, going back to Richard Nixon, has always made covert racial appeals, talking about issues such as war on drugs, law and order, welfare, have always been code words for race. Trump has made them overt. He's brought them together. He's brought into them the evangelicals, and especially we know white evangelicals are his strongest base, where it's over 70% of them are with him. And he's brought in now the respectability of white supremacists. It used to be Republicans would condemn neo-Nazis, would condemn white supremacists like David Duke, who ran for governor of Louisiana a couple of decades ago. But Trump has made those groups respectable. Remember a couple years ago with the demonstrations in Charlottesville where he wanted to basically say both sides were at fault and wouldn't condemn the supremacists. So what I've argued, and I think it dovetails with the Common Dreams piece, is that he's brought the white supremacists, he's brought the white evangelicals together. They have become the new Republican Party, where the Republican Party stands for something or nothing more than what race. And race becomes their identity politics with, among other things, guns as the way that they can enforce and maintain that authority within American society.
And Douglas Sloan, following that same logic, we also have the Tea Party. We have Tom Tancredo standing before the American people saying, we want our country back. And this thing now has shifted so far to the fascist side, so far to the white supremacist neo-Nazi side, we could almost sit back and wax romantic of the good old days of the Tea Party.
Yeah, I'm wondering where that original Tea Party is. They were so up in arms about raising the federal deficit and about the trillions of dollars that was being spent by the Democrats and Obama, hundreds of millions and billions of dollars being spent by Obama and the Democrats. Well, Obama lowered the deficit. Trump has raised the deficit into the trillions of dollars, and this Tea Party and all these Tea Party constituents haven't said anything about them raising the deficit. And if I could just dovetail on what the doctor was saying, he's right. Regarding Nixon, John Ehrlichman on his deathbed said that they knew that they couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin and then criminalizing both heavily, they could disrupt those communities. He says that, yes, Nixon was targeting black people with that war on drugs, and we're seeing Trump further what Nixon did, further what Reagan did with his continued war on drugs. So we're seeing both of those in tandem, and it's really interesting to see this kind of racist ideologies expand, not just against blacks, as with Nixon and Reagan, but also against Hispanics and against Jewish people. We are seeing a sustained hatred towards Jews in this country from this white supremacist wing of the Republican Party. And it's crazy to see so many Republicans stand silent in light of all of these racial attacks. It's mind-boggling. You wonder what happened to the Republican Party of yore.
Great observation there, that people wanted to think of the Republican Party as being the party about small government, about cutting the deficit, about cutting taxes. That doesn't seem to be the Republican Party anymore. That's almost a quaint image that, gosh, I wish that's what the Republican Party was about, because that would be at least respectable and you could have a great debate about the merits of government and taxes and stuff like that. But all that seems unimportant now, and it seems that all the Republican Party, the evangelicals care about, the supremacists care about, is race. Hatred of race. And also, I'm going to argue, it's not just hatred, but it's also fear. Fear of immigrants, fear of black people, fear of Jews. But then there's also this other perversity of one other emotion, which is resentment. You know, you would think that the farmers and the poor whites who are being screwed over by the Trump administration would actually care about those issues, but they're not important. What Trump has stoked in them is the sense of resentment, the idea that these people of color, these immigrants, these Jews are getting something they don't deserve. So it's an elixir of very toxic psychological emotions that Trump is eliciting that is now the glue that holds together the Republican Party.
In this Common Dreams piece, the Foreign Ministry of Uruguay has listed several crowded public venues which could pose a threat to travelers: theme parks, shopping centers, festivals, religious events, gastronomic fairs, and any kind of cultural or sporting event. They're getting right to the crux of why visitors, tourists, come to this country in the first place. So is it possible that not only are we looking at an impact of the sanctions on farmers in this country, we're looking at the economic impact that Trump's sanctions are having on farmers in this country and others, the steel industry and so on and so forth, but now this could have a serious international impact on tourism in this country.
Absolutely.
Douglas Sloan, your
Absolutely.
Thoughts?
Absolutely. I agree 110%. We are seeing foreign countries now, and I also read in the article that Japan was looking at issuing some type of travel advisory. So, I mean, and why wouldn't they? Technically, they would be prime targets for some of these white nationalists and white supremacists that go on these shooting sprees. They are interested in maintaining the safety of their citizens. When they travel to this country, you're right, they are going to these festivals. They are trying to experience a bit of Americana by going to football games and by going to events where there'll be a lot of people where mass shooter is going to be likely to strike. So you can't blame them for issuing these travel advisories. And you also have to, I agree with you 110%, eventually this type of stuff will affect the tourism industry. It has already, the trade war with China has already affected the farmers immensely. We may have permanently lost our soybean trade customers with China to Russia and Brazil, who has taken over our soybean trade and our soybean sales. We may never get that back. That will hit us in our pocketbook. That is a permanent effect of Trump's economic policy that may never be recovered. And who suffers? Farmers in red states.
David Schultz, Sydney, Australia is commenting on this. The Netherlands is commenting on this. Venezuela and Uruguay, Japan. Your thoughts on the ripple effect that this could have on tourism in this country?
Well, it's on tourism, but also on just the United States' general status in the world. If you want to hope at one point that the United States could take the moral high ground on human rights, what we're starting to now see here is that these indiscriminate killings, you know, against ethnic minorities, you know, what puts us no better than other countries in the world where we have criticized them for what? Also attacking ethnic minorities. So that's a problem. I think we could also make the argument, and I was thinking of this today as I'm putting together my syllabus. I'm going to be teaching international law this fall, that we are probably adrift and running aground, or rather afoul of several international law conventions and treaties. And then the third point I was going to mention here is that Trump's, through all these killings, Trump is getting his immigration policy through. What's the immigration policy? Basically, we're going to kill, intimidate, or scare away immigrants from coming into the United States. I mean, in many ways, what's the new Trump immigration policy? It's private thuggery with weapons, and that's exactly what we're seeing here.
Professor David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University and author of Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, as well as a new piece in Counterpunch entitled The New Politics of White Supremacist Evangelical Republican Party, as well as Douglas Sloan, principal of National Capital Strategy Group. Gentlemen, thank you both for your contributions to the Critical Hour. Thank you so much for taking time to come in and sit with us today.
Thank
Douglas
you, Douglas
Sloan.
Me.
Really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, it's called the metadata trap. The Trump administration is using the full power of the U.S. surveillance state against whistleblowers. Government whistleblowers are increasingly being charged under laws such as the Espionage Act. The problem is, they're not spies. Why are they being treated as such? And I gotta say, this is not just limited to the Trump administration. There are those that went this route under the Obama administration. I think John Kiriakou is one of those individuals. Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a web developer and technologist. He is Chris Garaffa. As always, Chris, welcome back.
Oh, very happy to be back on with you. Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by an ex-CIA intelligence analyst. He conducted the morning intelligence briefings based upon the president's daily brief for Reagan's five most senior national security advisors, including Vice President George H.W. Bush. In January 2003, he co-created Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS, to expose how intelligence is being falsified to, quote-unquote, justify the war in Iraq. You can find his work at raymcgovern.com. He is, as always, Ray McGovern. Ray, welcome back.
Thank you.
Ray, let me start with you. This whole issue of the surveillance state being used against whistleblowers, the story is regarding the Trump administration, but as I said earlier, we cannot limit this to the Trump administration. Your thoughts?
Well, you're quite right, Wilmer. Obama went after whistleblowers more times than all previous presidents put together. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. So this thing has been smoking for a while. It's pretty rigorous now. And as Michael Lee points out in this Intercept article, it's very, very difficult for journalists to apply their trade without being really, really dangerous to sources, and of course, even more dangerous is it for sources to give over confidential information. One thing that I hope we can discuss as we go on here is The Intercept itself. That is the Intercept website or whatever you call it.
Mm-hmm.
You got a very spotty record in all this, and makes me wonder why James Risen and others were happy to be employed by The Intercept. We could talk more about that later.
Chris Garofa, the second paragraph of this story, they're ordinary Americans, and like most of us, they carry smartphones that automatically get backed up to the cloud. When they want to talk to someone, they send them a text or call them on the phone. They use Gmail and share memes and talk politics. Sometimes they even log into these accounts from their work computers. Talk about the surveillance state and this whole metadata trap. The average person probably doesn't understand metadata.
That's right. There are a couple aspects to this. So first of all, you know, we know that the government partners, the CIA, NSA, and other law enforcement agencies partner with various technology companies, be it Facebook, Apple, Google, Skype, which is now owned by Microsoft, and many others, to be able to very simply query what it is that we're doing online, who we're talking to, you know, what we're talking about and things like that. The other aspect of this is for anyone, not just government employees, that your employer owns the computer you use or the phone you use for work. If they give you that phone or that computer, they own it, and they legally have the right in order, you know, to monitor anything you do on that. They can take screenshots, they can track your keystrokes, effectively anything that they want to do on that computer that they or phone that they have given you. And that has actually been the cause of some of the these whistleblowers being detected. They were searching for how to contact a journalist on their work computer, and that certainly can set off flags, right? If they're looking for how to securely send a message, but they're doing it on their work computer, that's something that, along with other parts of the investigation, can say, can point to them as the whistleblower. And it's so important that we say, you know, these are whistleblowers. These are not spies. These are people who are, who have seen something wrong. They know that there is something wrong happening. You know, and you mentioned John Kiriakou, there are many, many others, and they have tried to expose it. And they, often under the Obama administration, under the Trump administration, and even going back before that, they are the ones that are often targeted for retaliation, even though there are federal protections for whistleblowers.
And thank you very much, Chris. That takes me to my perfect setup for my next point to Ray. Ray, you were with the CIA for 27 years, I believe.
That's right.
We've got, again, John Kiriakou, who was with the CIA. Your very dear friend, Bill Binney, who was with the NSA. All of you all swore an oath to defend and protect the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. And this surveillance state, most Americans assume and go to sleep every night comfortably thinking that the surveillance state has been put in place to protect American citizens against outside forces interfering in domestic life. But now you have American citizens such as yourself, such as Bill Binney, such as John Kiriakou, who are now in fear of their lives and well-beings for honoring the oath they swore to defend and protect the Constitution against domestic threats. Talk about that, please. First of all, is my premise accurate? And if so, talk about that, please.
Well, your premise is accurate, Wilmer, and I'm glad you mentioned this. I've taken just one solemn oath in my whole life, and that is to defend and protect the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Now, an oath is an oath. A promise to keep information secret when that information reveals crimes, crimes against humanity, crimes against our Constitution, well, you can kind of see a conflict there, right? I mean, hello? So let's say, well, let's talk about James Risen. At the in the early fall, late summer of 2004, as George W. Bush was running for a second term, James Risen was told by Thomas Tam of the Justice Department that there was a blanket, a dragnet surveillance and gross violation of the Fourth Amendment of our Constitution, and it was being applied to all Americans. Okay? Now, James Risen, I don't know if he was served in the service or whether he ever took an oath to defend the Constitution, but if that were me or anyone who took that oath, we would be obliged under that oath, because promises are promises and they're important, but promises are secondary to the, well, a supervening value of an oath, okay? And when the oath is to the Constitution, that's what you should do. So what did Risen do? Well, he went to his superiors at the New York Times and said, "My God, I got the story. God, we got to get it out." And they said, "Oh, no, no, we can't do that. Why not?" "Well, it's the election coming up." "Yeah, but it's 4 months away." "Oh, no, no, we can't do it now." And so they sat on it, not only for 4 months, they sat on it for a year and 4 months. And only in December of the following year, 2005, did it come out that James Risen had this information because he put it in his book. Now, what I'm saying about that is that the press is willing to obfuscate this kind of thing, suppress this information. And I had a chance in a public gathering to ask James Risen, "Jim, did it ever occur to you that this was so important 4 years before George Bush was likely to get another term, that it was so important that you might leak it, that you might be a whistleblower yourself?" And he sort of, you know, shrugged that off. Well, you know, I think that even journalists are not exempt from the obligation to adhere to the Constitution. And I think this is a really good case in point where Jim didn't measure up. And there have been several cases since, most recently on Monday, where Jim's getting himself in some real trouble.
Chris Garaffa, you're a web developer. You're a technologist. You spend a lot of your waking hours focused on these issues. How concerned are you? How concerned should journalists be that, particularly journalists whose job it is, as the fourth estate, I think is what journalists are called?
Yep.
The guard against the very practices that we now find our government involved in. And perfect example I think I'll use here is WikiLeaks and the fact that there has not been one shred of information that has been released through WikiLeaks that has been proven, even alleged, to have been wrong. But somehow, publishing accurate information is secondary to the fact that the information was published. Hopefully that wasn't too convoluted of a question or statement.
No, I think that's a really important question. And since you brought up WikiLeaks, I just want to mention, if people haven't heard, you know, Chelsea Manning could spend, the judge ruled, up to another year in jail right now. Mm-hmm. Chelsea Manning is still in jail for refusing to violate her own rights to and answer outrageous questions. Now, the question of a journalist's job, and I you know, we need to look at this on a local level, a national level. If a journalist is just rubber stamping what the government says, what a corporation says, what an agency says, they're not really doing a journalist's job. And even, you know, well before the advent of all of this modern technology, journalists themselves, you know, they were often targets of corporations, of the government, whether it blacklists or, you know, direct harassment, intimidation, and violence for exposing corruption, for exposing crimes. So this isn't new. And frankly, if a journalist isn't doing their, you know, if the journalist is doing their job, this is part of the job. It has become much easier for the government or for corporations, because these corporations are powerful entities, we have to remember, and they're also engaged in a lot of this spying, to detect when somebody is talking to a journalist or when a journalist is going to publish with them. There are so many tools out there, and this article mentions some of them: Signal for text messaging and phone calls, or the Tor browser for browsing the internet, and then many others. But you have to know how to use them and use them properly before you can even, you know, before you can be sure that your communications are going to be secure and private.
Ray McGovern, I want to kind of take this back as we wrap this up. I want to take this back to the what I think is a fundamental premise of this story, and that is employees of the government. John Kiriakou, who exposed the reality of torture being employed at Guantanamo Bay, operatives of the U.S. government violating American law and violating international law. Your dear friend Bill Binney, who was with the NSA, blew the whistle on the NSA. And as I understand it, the only reason that Bill Binney isn't in prison or didn't go to prison was because the depth and breadth of the information that he had, they realized he was really too big of a fish for them to mess with. But the average government employee who thinks that by blowing the whistle on their agency for violating American law is actually the right thing to do, that individual, in many instances, finds themselves facing the power of the state. And that is a power that in most cases is insurmountable.
That's right, Wilmer. Let me just comment on Bill. Now, Bill wasn't a whistleblower in the traditional sense. He and his three colleagues, Kirk Wiebe, Ed Loomis, and Tom Drake, plus the House Intelligence Committee staffer, Diane Roark, they went through channels. They whistleblew according to the rules. And the government came at them, raided their homes, even knowing that they were not the source of James Risen's article. I mentioned who was the source, is well known now as Tom Tam. They knew that at the time they raided these people's offices. Now, what I'd like to make a point about is Bill Binney. Okay, now, he is the best on Russiagate. He is the fellow who can say, hey, guess what? Not only was there no collusion, the Russians didn't do anything with respect to hacking into the DNC computer. Guess what? I can prove it. Now, what does James Risen of The Intercept do? Well, he goes on air on Monday evening on The Rising, run by The Hill newspaper, and he says, Bill Binney is a conspiracy theorist. He's a conspiracy theorist. Don't believe him. He's really gone off the deep end. It was apropos of nothing. Now, why do you suppose James Risen would do that? Well, my guess is James Risen has lost all his sources because of the surveillance techniques described so well in this article. So what's he going to do? Well, instead of trying to ferret out information from people at middle levels, as he used to do, he's lost all that. No one will talk to him. So he's currying favor. He's trying to ingratiate himself with the people who want him to say Bill Binney is a conspiracy theorist. It was apropos of nothing. And so this is really, really bad when you have somebody of the stature of James Risen, given the fact that he's a devotee of Russiagate, that he will slander, and I use the word advisedly, slander Bill Binney by calling him a conspiracy theorist. And it was on the same day that a piece by Patrick Lawrence appeared in consortiumnews.com, which gives the lie to all this business about Russian hacking into the DNC. Coincidence? Maybe. But they're after Bill Binney big time. And why? Well, I can only guess that, you know, James Risen has to have some sources within the intelligence community. Now, instead of the guys blowing the whistle, it's the guys promoting the stories, and James Risen has let himself be dragooned into that. It's a sad, sad thing.
So how stifling of a reality is this for conscientious, law-abiding, constitutional-protecting employees such as yourself and Bill and the others?
Well, you know, I would say this. The lie detector test was a real deterrent, okay? We knew that we would be subjected to that every couple of years. Now, for good or ill, that was a deterrent, and it prevented me from saying some things that I may have said about Vietnam that might have conceivably ended the war earlier than it did. Now, not only do they have lie detector tests, they monitor everything you say, everything you email, everything you pretty much do in a very easy way to ferret that information out. So, yeah, it's really, really difficult for people like Risen to have sources now. And that's why I think The Intercept itself and Risen sort of curry favor through Pierre Omidyar with the powers that be, so they won't be completely out of a job, that they'll be able to write stories, even if they happen to be stories this time that are kind of according to what the government wants our populace to hear.
Ray McGovern and Chris Garaffa, as always, gentlemen, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour. And as always, look forward to having you guys back.
Most welcome.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right, folks. You've been listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out!